Okay, and every time I start a recording, I always like to do an introduction as well and say good morning. This is Thursday morning, September 3rd. We're here at 8 a.m. Chem 30A, and we're going to do numbers and chemistry today. That's where we're starting off. And I really didn't. I'm going to honor Krista's schedule as well. So Krista has that we start our first lab next Tuesday. And that's great. I just wanted to sort of get in a lab lecture before that would give you guys some idea of where we're going to be going with that and how we treat numbers in chemistry, because it really is part of the foundation of everything that we wind up doing in chemistry. And maybe even before I start that, there's two things that I want to cover. Number one, I want to make sure that we're all comfortable using Zoom and understand how to communicate feedback. I'm really good at following the chat, and so that you guys can type questions to me over in the chat, and usually I will look up and get those. So the chat is here, and I very rarely put anything in the chat while I'm actually lecturing. And when you throw questions to me in the chat, even if they're private questions, when they're private questions, I respect the privacy of the question and I will not out the student who asked it, but I will respond to it verbally and communicate that out to everybody. And I encourage you guys to use the chat to ask questions of me. But also, sometimes I may miss a question or something. Feel free to respond to your fellow students in the chat if you so desire. And if you want to send private messages back and forth, that doesn't bother me at all. I never see it. That's entirely up to you guys. So the chat is there for you guys to use. And like I said, I'm good at following it. The other thing is, oftentimes it's difficult for a lecturer to look and see a blank canvas on the screen. So right now it's as if I'm doing a recorded lecture and there's nobody here watching because nobody's got their cameras on. For me as a lecturer, I am highly sensitive to people's faces and expressions while I'm lecturing. I can often tell when a student is tracking and when they're not. I can tell when they're understanding something and when they're not. I can see those aha moments. I can see when total confusion is sitting there. And those nonverbal cues oftentimes determine how I proceed through a lecture as well. Without that, I just kind of go on autopilot. So it's a little bit harder when people aren't here. So frequently what I'll do is I'll stop and I'll ask how everybody's doing. And so some of the communication that you can do for me is if you look down at the bottom of your screen, you'll see a little button that says reactions. And if you bring up those reactions, you can give me a thumbs up. You can applaud when I say something funny. You can throw out a celebration for an aha moment when something is making sense. There's just some abilities to be able to communicate to me non-verbally so that I can see that you're tracking with me. If I'm asking, how's everybody doing? Is everybody doing okay? You can give me a thumbs up. If you have a question, and you'd like to ask that question verbally, then a way that you can do that is through the participant list. So if you look at the bottom of your screen, you'll see a thing that says participants. And right now we have 9 participants. In there is some other communication. You can say yes, you can say no, you can give me a go slower or go faster. And under more, there's also thumbs up, there's a raised hand function in here someplace. There's some more icons. You can say that you're out to tea or out to coffee, which means you've stepped away from the computer for a minute. So all of those types of communications are there as well. So I encourage you guys to use those different types of communication. And I do not have it such that your mics are permanently unmuted. You can unmute yourself at any time and throw out a verbal question at any time. You can also press the space bar, and the space bar will unmute you as long as you have the space bar pressed. And you are always welcome to jump in and ask a verbal question. If I'm in the middle of saying something, please jump in and interrupt me. I welcome all questions. I celebrate all questions. And I will almost always thank you for your question after asking it, because those are really important to me. Angelica, you're asking where the lab recordings are going to be posted. I'm going to post them in two places. So unlike most professors are uploading all of their materials to YouTube, which means that when you're finished watching the video, often you're shown a whole bunch of commercials from the end of YouTube. Some instructors are uploading them to Zoom itself, but then those have an expiration date and they disappear. So I have my own website that I maintain, and my own website is at chemed.study. And you just go into the web browser and you type chemed.study, hit return, and it takes you to the website where I'm going to upload things. Now, I'm going to link to them from our Canvas site. So within the modules, each module where we're doing a lab, I will link these lab lectures in those individual modules. So I'll set a link to them and embed them so that you can probably watch them directly from the Canvas shell, but you can also go to chemed.study, and on the right-hand side of the page, you'll see links for the different courses that I teach. The Chem30A link, if you click it, will take you to a Chem30A page, and I will have a link on here where all of the lab recordings will be maintained. And similarly, I'll show you my Chem3 class from the summer, because that one's entirely fleshed out. But if you go to my Chem3 class from the summer, there you'll see a tab that says lecture Zoom recordings. And underneath that, I post both the notes, the audio, and the lecture, the video with audio, just thinking that some people might want to use it as a podcast sometimes, and they don't want to watch the entire video. And sometimes they just want to listen to it while they're doing other things. And I post a summary of what that lecture covered, so that you can easily scroll through. You'll see the dates, you'll see the topic that was covered on that date, and all the materials are there. So that's where you would find it. And it is https://chemed.study. So there you go. There's the link to be able to get to that homepage. Okay. Let's see. And as I was saying, please interrupt me at any time if you have questions. Don't feel bad about interrupting me. In fact, that's the way that I get to know you guys, is through conversation. So I encourage you to use the chat, use your voice, and participate as much as you can, okay? Let me stop there for a second and ask if there are any questions so far. And let's give a trial and see how you guys are doing. See if you can give me some thumbs up through those reactions. Excellent. All right, you guys are figuring this out. I like it. That's working well. Let's see, I was gonna say one other thing besides introducing you to where the website is, making sure that you understand that you can interrupt me at any time. And the other thing that I want to do is just a little bit of setting expectations. So let's set some realistic expectations. And I feel that this is an important thing to say. And I will say it frequently throughout the semester in setting realistic expectations. You guys signed up to take chemistry. And in Chem30A, the Chem30A class, typically you guys are oriented towards certain health, allied health careers. And so you're going into nursing, you're going into dental hygiene, you're going into radiation technologies, you're going into medical assisting, or there's a whole kinesiology. There's a whole host of areas where you guys go. And for almost all of those areas, chemistry tends to be an impediment for you achieving your goals. And there is a lot of anxiety around the chemistry classes and a lot of apprehension about taking chemistry. And it's there for a good reason, because a lot of people struggle with chemistry. So, And the reason that they struggle with chemistry, to be perfectly honest with you, is that chemistry is challenging for two reasons. One, we use a lot of math. And so math tends to be a weakness for a lot of people. And so that math component, when you sign up for a chemistry class, you also sign up partially for a math class. The other reason is that when you sign up for chemistry, you also sign up for a symbolic language class. Now, most people have difficulty with foreign languages. We think of a foreign language as taking a foreign language as being a challenging subject to take. And chemistry is a foreign language. Carolyn, I see your question. I'll get it in a second. Chemistry is a foreign language, and it's a symbolic foreign language, like taking Mandarin. And most of us would have a hard time conceptually thinking about taking Mandarin with its symbolic language and learning what each symbol means and how to use it and how to construct sentences and paragraphs in that foreign language. And so chemistry is a combination of both a math class and a foreign language class, a symbolic foreign language class, and that's what makes it so challenging. And so the teaching of a class like this depends a lot, or I should say the success of students in a class like this depends a lot on your instructor and how we guide you through that subject and reducing down the cognitive load. And that's one of my specialties, I think, is trying to reduce down the cognitive load of teaching a subject like this, trying to make it tangible, approachable, trying to make it safe, but also letting you know, when you go to the doctor and you have a procedure and the doctor says to you, this is going to hurt for about a minute. And after a minute, the medication that I'm going to give you is going to kick in and the pain is going to subside and you're going to be okay. And it's going to reach its maximum at about 45 seconds, and then it's going to decrease. And so you get mentally prepared for that. You get mentally set and you go into that. And if the doctor didn't tell you that, and that pain kept ramping up for 45 seconds, at about 45 seconds, panic starts kicking in. And you think, oh my God, this is not going well. Something is terribly wrong. And as that panic kicks in, everything can just go to hell all of a sudden. But when you know that 15 seconds after that, it's about to get a whole lot better, you can relax somewhat and you have some trust in that doctor that that's the way that it's going to be. And so for many of our subjects, I'm going to tell you, hey, this is going to be confusing for about 45 minutes. And after 45 minutes, there's going to be some aha moments that are going to start setting in and everything is going to be okay. And we're going to start making sense out of it. And I'm going to tell you sometimes that when you're doing homework, there's going to be some struggle involved, that for the first half an hour when you're doing that homework or the first couple of problems, it's going to be a struggle. And that's okay. It's okay to struggle with chemistry because that means that you're learning it. Whenever we start a new process or start to learn how to play a new instrument, there's always some struggle that's involved before we start to become comfortable and before we start to become proficient. And so I want to give you guys permission to know that and to be kind to yourselves and to know that I know that and that we're going to have some struggle together. We're going to have some confusion together, but that there is light at the end of the tunnel and that we do come out of it and that we can all get there together. And that part of my teaching is trying to bring us all there together as well. So that's my promise to you, is that I'm going to be honest with you when things are challenging, and I'll be honest with you when I expect that things might be a little bit confusing for a while, and when you need to hang tight with me and hang on for those aha moments, and we'll get there together. That's what I look forward to. Okay, Carolyn, you asked, when will your homework assignments and quizzes be on Canvas? So Carolyn, let's be clear about the structure of the class too. So I'm the lab teacher, and my job is primarily to teach lab. I will backfill some of Krista's lectures, and I will answer any questions in office hours and within the lab setting that you guys have. And I will frequently come in and say, hey, is there any confusion? What subject would you like me to look at first? And I will take questions from lecture or lab and always deal with those at the beginning of lecture. But Krista has already done all of the heavy lifting and has built the Canvas shell such that all of the homework and all of the assignments and quizzes are already in place within Canvas, and that this is a unified class, that lecture and lab are one grade and one class, and there is only one Canvas shell. and Krista has already built that Canvas shell. I'm going to integrate into it so that I will slot my office hours and my contact information. I'll put them on the same page as Krista's. And within the modules, where Krista has already outlined the modules that have both the lecture content, the lab content, and the quizzes all built into that. So if I go into the Canvas shell and show you, let me go try and show you real quick. Let me go in as a teacher into that Canvas shell. And we are the Chem 30A1 section. And if I go into modules and I look at the modules here, she has all of the introductions, instructor contact information. And so here is Krista's biography and how you will contact Krista. I'm going to go into that page and I'm going to edit that page to add my content into it. And I'll do that over this weekend and slot everything in there. And when you go down to the resources, let's see, here we are, chapter one, matter and measurement. When you look at this and you see matter and measurement overview, the textbook chapter one, the chapter one lecture notes, the PDF, all of those are Krista's lecture notes. But then you get down to chapter one, lecture part one, part two, part three. You get down to the assignments. And then here's the assignment that I'm looking for, which is the lab activity. Number one, math and the calculator. That's really my domain. That's my part where I'm going to be teaching how to do this part. Now, Krista has a lab lecture that goes along with this that is there for her sections. And I can't tell if she deleted it out of our Canvas shell. She may have. She may have left it only in her Canvas shell. It's okay whether she deleted it or not. We're going to cover it all. But here where it says lab activity one, math and the calculator, this is the activity that we are going to do next Tuesday. And on this activity, and it's a little bit difficult for me to show, but going back to the assignment itself, when you bring this up, you'll see a submit button in the upper right-hand corner. That's where you'll submit this assignment once we complete it next Tuesday. And so all of the assignments are here within the Canvas shell. The quiz, quiz chapter one, matter and measurement, that is the quiz for the lecture component. And those things are going to be done according to Krista's schedule and according to Krista's due dates. And I'm going to adhere to those schedules and due dates as well, such that we'll be covering the lab assignments on the day that they are set within the schedule. And to show you where that schedule is, Krista had it up here under, where did she have it? Guidelines and etiquette, participation, grading, academic and accessibility, tech support, quiz zero, wrap up. Oh, the schedule is hiding. Maybe it's somewhere in about our class. Student learner outcomes. She had a whole schedule online and I had been looking at it multiple times. And now I don't see where she put it. It's a little bit different when I look on this chemistry tutoring, tech support, student resources, quiz, week zero wrap up. I don't know, I'll have to find it. It's a little bit different when looking in this app on my iPad versus looking at it online. If I go to it and I look at it online, I might be able to find it, but there's a schedule that is in there, that is in the Canvas shell, that has all of the due dates for everything. And I thought it was where she had her syllabus. And so maybe it wasn't in the modules. But I don't even see where she's got the syllabus at this point. Maybe it's in about our class. And I'm still not seeing it there. Okay, I apologize. I'm not sure where she's hiding it. Okay, I'll find it later. And maybe at some point we can take a little break during class. I can find it and then I can put it in the chat and put a direct link to it so that we can just click on that link and get to it pretty easily. But there is a schedule that Krista has already put together that is attached to her syllabus that has both the lecture activities, the lab activities, the quizzes, all the due dates of when those things are expected to be due. And you can also go to the calendar within Canvas and you can see each one of those due dates within the Canvas calendar. And hopefully that answers your question, Carolyn. So it's all one unified class and I won't be posting any separate due dates. I will only be following all of the due dates that Krista has already put together within that Canvas shell. So I hope that answers the question. Anything else come up for anybody? Or any other questions I can answer before we jump into doing some of this content that I want to do today? All right, I always like to give it a minute to give it that pause and let you guys think if there's anything, because as soon as I start up again, that question all of a sudden jumps to mind. And like I said, don't be afraid to interrupt me. Don't be afraid to interrupt me at any point, should there be any questions. Okay. The way that I like to work, for those of you who are new to my style of teaching, and I know that I've got one student in here that I had last semester in Chem 3 who is a Chem 38 convert. And so, but for those of you who aren't used to me, I like to do everything off the cuff. I don't like to have PowerPoint slides. It's just my teaching style. I've never liked PowerPoint in the same way that I don't like Canvas. I'm not adverse to technology. I'm actually very technology savvy. I do a lot of HTML programming I just do it coding by hand. I do a lot of computational chemistry. Much of my life is online and I live on computers, but I have a certain teaching style that I dislike pre-done content in a way. And that's because I like to adjust to my students' questions. Well, it's for two reasons. I like to adjust to your questions. And I feel that I can only really do that if I can draw everything. And number two, the other reason for that is that I get excited when I'm teaching chemistry. And when I get excited, I can go fast. And if it's PowerPoint, oh man, you guys are toast. Even if you had PowerPoint slides, it might be challenging to keep up with me if I'm riffing on a PowerPoint slide. And so drawing slows me down and it allows me to think. And I think best on paper. And so whiteboards and whiteboard applications that allow me to be able to draw and bring in images that I've hand drawn. That's my preferred medium. So that's where we're gonna go. So let's go to that. And let's start here with numbers in chemistry. So when we start talking about numbers in chemistry, the reason that we start here is because there's, everything that we do from here on out is going to be qualitative, quantitative in the way that we look at matter and conduct measurements. And because we start at the point of conducting measurements within chemistry, and that's the foundation for everything that we're going to talk about is how we measure things, we need to have an agreement on how we are going to treat numbers within chemistry. And everybody says, well, numbers are just numbers. And that's really not true. We have three different types of numbers that fall into two broad categories within chemistry. So the two broad categories are measurements and numbers that have uncertainty and numbers that are, that have no uncertainty, that are whole numbers or defined values, definitions. So let me put it this way. We have measurements. And measurements have uncertainty associated with them. of value. And then on the other side of the coin, we have what are called definitions. Numbers that have been defined, and counted values. These have no uncertainty. These are exact. That's the word that I've been looking for. And so that key word is uncertainty. And numbers that have uncertainty and numbers that do not. And the problem is that all numbers look the same. And so it is about how the number is obtained that is critically important, that defines what category it falls into, whether it falls into a value that is a measurement that has uncertainty or a value that is a definition or a counted value that has no uncertainty. Let's start with measurements that have uncertainty, and then we'll wrap back around and we'll look at these definitions and these counted values and figure out what makes those different. So when I do a measurement, the thing about doing a measurement, and let me grab a, that is not the way I wanted to do that. Let me grab, I think I do it this way. Yes. Let me grab a picture here to start with. And what I'm going to try to do is sometimes I have these images that I have drawn that I don't want to take up your time watching me draw something complicated. And so I will bring in an image that I have taken some time to draw the night before class or the morning before class starts. But I always bring it into these notes because these are the notes that get posted online. So I like to have all of these things rather than jumping back and forth between slides. I like to have them all in one place so that when you go back and you watch the lecture or you review the notes, all of the content is contained in the same place. Okay, so most of us are used to doing measurements in our life. We have gone to the grocery store and put things on a scale to figure out how much they weigh so that in the vegetable section, we know how many pounds we're purchasing. Most of us have used a ruler before in some aspect, either in trying to build something or measuring to hang a picture or measuring to see whether or not a bed is going to fit through a door or any of those aspects. In the course of grade school or high school, we've used measurements countless times to be able to measure things and do little science projects. And every time that we have done that, I can almost guarantee that what you have used is a tape measure or a ruler that was in inches. And when we use a ruler that is in inches, they are almost always uniformly marked out in 16ths of an inch. And so we have two different types of systems. We have the English system, which is based in inches, and the metric system, which is based in metric units, in what we call SI units. And SI stands for System International. And those SI units are based in units and powers of 10. And we think of that as the metric system is another word that we use to describe that. Almost uniformly, we are going to use the metric system, but we need to be able to convert back and forth between those. When you use the English system, the ruler is almost always marked out in 16ths. And when we measure to the closest 16th of an inch. And so we would say it's an inch and a half, an inch and a quarter, an inch and a 16th. Maybe it was marked out in 30 seconds. And so we get an inch and 1/32nd. And we always just go to the closest line and call it good. But that's not how scientists read a ruler. Scientists read a ruler in a different way because scientists don't have one ruler. We have many different rulers, and our rulers change depending upon what it is we're trying to measure. And when we're measuring a really big thing, we'll use a ruler that is less accurate. When we're measuring a really, really tiny thing, we use a much more accurate ruler. And because we have so many different rulers with so many different types of markings, we have to have a system by which we agree on how we read the markings. So what I have down here is an example of a key set against three different rulers that are marked to different degrees. And these represent the different types of rulers that a chemist might use to measure something. And so these are marked in centimeters. And to give you an idea, a centimeter is 2.5 centimeters is about the length of an inch. It's actually 2.54 to be exact. And so this key, which I usually think of as about maybe an inch long, here is showing up on this ruler, which is marked out in ones, and there are no markings in between. The key falls greater than 2 centimeters. And what a chemist does, or a scientist, all scientists, they do this in all the different fields. And so it doesn't matter whether you're studying physics, chemistry, engineering, even in within biology, we all agree to read measurements in the exact same way within the sciences. And what we do is we read out the certain digits, meaning that the key is greater than 2, and then we estimate a final digit. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to delete these estimated digits. And we're going to read these rulers ourselves. And I'm going to ask you guys to put it in the chat to estimate what you think this digit is right here. And so how far between the 2 and the 3 is it? Is it halfway in between? Is it 2.4? Is it 2.3? Is it 2.2? Is it 2.1? Give me an idea of what you think that last digit is that's there. And just go ahead. There's no right or wrong answer. Well, okay, there's some wrong answers and there's some right answers. But what I'd like to see you do is I'd like to see you try and guess at what you think that last digit is and what it should be in that place. So go ahead and throw it in the chat. And you can throw it in as 2 point something. So tell me what that last thing is. 2.3, 2.1. I like it. Excellent. Anybody else feel comfortable throwing it in the chat? And you can agree or you can disagree. You can throw in a different number than what most people are throwing in there, and that's fine. Okay, 2.1, 2.3, I agree with both of those. When I read it at about 2.2. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to change the color here, and I'm going to say that this digit here is the estimated digit. And what we mean by estimated is that when I look at that reading, so I'm going to scroll down here for a second and say that on the first ruler, let's take that screen snapshot of this guy. On the first ruler, what we're doing is the ruler is marked out to ones, and we are reading that measurement to the tenths position. And we're saying that this measurement is 2.2 centimeters. And the intention is that it is plus or minus 0.1 centimeters. And what that means is that there's a range that this measurement falls within. This measurement can be as big as 2.3 centimeters and as small as 2.1 centimeters. And that this is the range, the uncertainty within the measurement. So that uncertainty resides in every measurement. And when a measurement is given to you, you need to only simply look at the last digit in the measurement and think that that measurement goes plus or minus one in that last digit. And so no matter what measurement anybody gives you, now you can look at it and you can know how good the ruler was that was used to make the measurement. For instance, let's take an example. Let's say that somebody hands you a measurement that is 31.62 meters. I would look at this measurement and I would say that the last digit in this measurement is the uncertain digit. And that I would interpret this measurement to be plus or minus 0.01 meters. And that means that when I look at this measurement, that I could read this and I could say that this measurement could be as large as 31.63 meters or as small as 31.61 meters. Another example might be that I have a really large measurement and that that measurement could be something like 21,000 liters, a measurement of volume. And here, the interpretation is that in the last non-zero digit, in this position, would reside the uncertainty. And that this number would be plus or minus, let's do it this way, plus or minus 1,000 liters. And so that this number could be as big as 22,000 liters or as small as 20,000 liters, and that it varies in that last position. And the question is, okay, well, why don't I just go all the way to where these zeros are here? Well, we have a system within chemistry that if we want these zeros to be important and we want them to be part of the measurement, then what we do is we include a decimal place. And we would say that the decimal place is there and that the only reason to include the decimal place in this position like this is because I want the uncertainty to reside right next to that decimal place. And so that decimal place is critically important. And that this is going to be plus or minus 1 liter. And so it could be as big as 21,001, or it could be as small as 999 liters. And that would be how small that measurement would be. And it would tell me about how good the ruler was that was used to be able to make the measurement. Okay. When we change the rulers, let's go back up and look at the key example. When we change the ruler and we put finer gradations, markings on the ruler, then we can read it to a higher degree of uncertainty. And so what we see here is that now when I look at the ruler, if I blow this up to make it a little bit easier to read, this ruler is marked out in tenths and the line is falling in between, this would be 0.1, 0.2 and 0.3. We're falling in between 2.2 and 2.3. And so we need to estimate what that next decimal is. So it's definitely 2.2 and then it falls somewhere in between. Maybe you guys can tell me what that measurement would read as, 2.2 what? 2.25, exactly. It's falling right in between. Now, some people might see that as 2.24, or some people might see that as 2.26. All of those would be correct answers. And so what we'll do is we will include the uncertain digit in here as 2.25, and that is my estimated digit. And that means that the measurement could be as big as 2.26 or as small as 2.24. And that tells me about how good the ruler was that was used to make the measurement. Let's do the last one. So the last one now, I've taken a ruler and I've put a ton of markings in it. There are 100 divisions between the 2 and the 3. And so with 100 divisions in between, if I even blow this up, it's hard to see. But what I've done is I've made an even bigger blow up. And so this line is falling. Here is 2. This is 2.1. This is 2.2. This is 2.21, 22, 23, 24, 25. And then I need to estimate beyond the 2.25. And so to estimate beyond the 2.25, I need to know where that line falls. And it looks like it's falling just a little bit to the left of where the 2.25 is. And so we could call this 2.249, or we could call it 2.250. If the line is right on the mark, and I'm sorry, I can't make my pointer any smaller. As I blow up the screen, the pointer just keeps getting bigger as well. But if it's falling right on the mark, then I add a zero onto it and estimate that it is right on the mark, that is at the zero position. And so that's the way that I would read this measurement, is that I would read this measurement as falling right on that zero mark, and that is my estimated digit, 2.250, based on where that line is falling. And again, it tells me how good the ruler is. And so you can see that by using different rulers, we can get different degrees of uncertainty within the measurement, less uncertainty with the smaller gradations that we get within a ruler. Okay. Let me grab another image. Let's grab these two. And we'll take these two items over. And we can even blow them up a bit. And let's try to read these measurements and see how you guys do. Okay, so these rulers are marked out in tenths. So this is 1.1, 1.2, 1.3. We're up to 1.5, and we're in between the 1.5 and the 1.6. So how would we read that measurement, or what measurement would we take there, being in between the 1.5 and the 1.6? You guys want to throw it into the chat? Tell me what you think. I could go with that. 1.58, I like that too. So, and you guys are helping me out considerably in that you're not all reporting the same measurement. So I'm seeing 1.59 centimeters. I'm seeing 1.58 centimeters. And that is as expected, that when different people read the ruler, different people will estimate the last digit differently. And that just highlights the uncertainty in the measurement, that the uncertainty is in that last digit. And so you guys are doing an excellent job and helping me out significantly by showing that uncertainty by reporting different measurements. That's excellent. Okay, so I would agree with both of these. And I would say that this measurement, if I were to read it, I might go with a 1.58. And so I would record 1.58 centimeters. And that means that it is plus or minus 0.01 centimeters based on the ruler that we have used. Let's try and read this one. So how would you read that measurement of where that line is falling? This one is also marked in tenths. So without me prompting and reading the ruler for you, give me an idea on what you think this measurement might be. Kimberly, excellent. And Haley, you guys are on it. Okay, perfect. And I'm seeing some agreement in this, that is falling just about in the center. And I would agree that this is 7.05 centimeters. And that means that it's plus or minus 0.01 centimeters as well. Okay, now there's another style of measurement that we do that is very common within chemistry. And that is that we have something that is called a graduated cylinder for measuring volumes. Let me grab a couple of graduated cylinders and show you, let's see, let me go up to these. Okay, graduated cylinders are used to measure volume of liquids within chemistry. And rather than having a horizontal ruler, they have a vertical ruler. So you can see that this starts off at the bottom at zero and goes up in volume with the volume placed into the cylinder. And so that we read this from the bottom up, essentially, just like we would any other ruler. However, liquids, interestingly, do something different than solids in that they have a surface tension. And because of that surface tension, they climb the walls of the glass. They actually adhere to the glass to a small degree. And there's an attractive force between the glass and the liquid. We would say that glass is really hydrophilic. It likes water. And so the water actually grabs onto the glass and climbs up the glass to a small degree. And we call this shape, this concave shape, we call it a meniscus. And the device is calibrated to read at the bottom of the meniscus. And so what I've done here is I've blown this up, but I have a picture, and this is just a crude picture of an eyeball, that what we do when we read the meniscus on a graduated cylinder is we always read at the bottom of the meniscus. The device is calibrated such that if all this liquid were to fall down and be perfectly level, that perfectly level position would be this position, and that's where the ruler is calibrated. So we always read at the bottom of the meniscus, but we read it exactly the same way as we read any other ruler. So this ruler is likewise marked out in tenths. So as I'm reading this, this is 9, 9.1, 9.2, 9.3. And maybe you guys could read this at the bottom of the meniscus and where that dotted line is falling in here. And this is going to be in milliliters. So see if you can give me a reading in milliliters of what this volume actually is. 9.28, 9.27. I'm liking both of those. Excellent. Let's go with the 9.28. So this would be 9.28 milliliters. And that means that it would be plus or minus 0.01 milliliters. Could be as big as 9.29, could be as small as 9.27. Okay. Be careful when you read the rulers that when you look at the ruler that you actually first start off by understanding how big the markings on the ruler are. For instance, 7, 7.1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There's 10 divisions between the 7 and the 8. That means that it is marked in tenths. And so when I'm reading this, this would be 7, this would be 8, this would be 7.5, right in the middle. And so if I'm counting those marks, I'm reading 9, 9.1, 9.2, and then I estimate in between the 9.2 and 9.3. And so, Carolyn, that might be a typo that you've got in there in that you missed the 2 that comes before the 8. And if it were at the, yes, you missed the 2. Okay, I just wanted to make sure. This is part of the thing too, is that sometimes, this is about the way that I like to test. I prefer not to use multiple choice tests. I prefer to have people write out answers and to write out as much information on the test as they can as to the assessment that they're making and why they're making it. Because sometimes we make mistakes. And I like to grade with a lot of partial credit. And so I like to understand the mistakes that my students are making, as opposed to sometimes it's just a typo, sometimes it's a misunderstanding of what the ruler actually says. But yeah, 9.28 is a perfectly good answer. So that's great here. It looks like everybody's understanding. Okay, are there any questions on how we're reading rulers or what we're doing here? Just everybody's doing okay and we can give me a thumbs up and we're doing all right. Okay, cool. So along with this, when we're looking at values, measurement, a measurement has two parts. There is the value and there is the unit. The value, this is the number. The unit tells me what is being measured. You have to have both parts. The unit on its own is meaningless without the value. The value on its own is meaningless without the unit. And so whenever we take a measurement, it is always critical that we not only record the value, but we also record the unit. These are things like centimeters or meters or liters. Could be inches, could be feet, could be gallons. And so the unit always needs to be there along with a measurement. So make sure that whenever you're recording a measurement, that you are also recording the unit. Okay, so we've gone through measurements and we've talked about measurements and how numbers are handled. So we've kind of covered this piece for the moment. Now what we need to talk about is over here, definitions and counted values, things that have no uncertainty in them. Let's take this key. We'll use the key as an example. Let's talk about counted values. Values that are exact, meaning no uncertainty. So values that are exact that have no uncertainty. If I ask you to tell me how many keys are in the image, I'm not asking you to measure, I'm asking you to count. So we're asking, how many keys are here? And you look at that and you would say 3 keys. This is a counted value rather than measured. And you could say, well, wait a minute, on the ruler, I counted the number of spaces on the ruler. How is that any different than counting the keys? Well, the difference is that the keys have no ability to have half a key or a quarter of a key, that keys come in whole numbers and that you can't get a partial part of a key. And therefore, when I count these, they come in an exact value and there's no ability to be a partial value. And so these counted values are said to be exact and carry no uncertainty with them. So there is no plus or minus. They're just an exact value. And you need to be careful on determining whether a value is counted or measured, because you can't look at the number on its own and determine whether a number is counted or measured. For instance, let me show an example here. Let's look at a value that is 3 feet versus 3 pens. 3 feet, when I measure a foot, I need to use a ruler to measure that. And that there are gradations in the ruler and uncertainty within the ruler. So this was obtained by a ruler, and therefore contains uncertainty. And so we would say that this is 3 feet plus or minus 1 foot, meaning that it could be as big as 4 feet or as small as 2 feet. So this value measured, even though it looks like it's a whole value and looks like it was counted, based on the unit that is being used of feet, it had to have been measured. 3 pens, the unit here, there is no ability to get a part of a pen. If we're counting the number of pens that are in a box, the pens are going to come in whole pen values. And there is no way to get a half a pen or a quarter of a pen. And so this is obtained by counting. And as such, it is exact. There is no plus minus in terms of that. Does that make sense? And so you can't look at the value on its own, because each of these values, the 3 and the 3, they look identical. To tell whether something was measured or exact, you need to understand how it was obtained. You need to understand whether or not a ruler was used, or whether the value was a counted value. And most of the things, we can look at the unit, and by the unit, the type of unit that it is, we can tell whether or not it was counted or whether it was measured, okay? The other type of exact value is a definition. So a definition is a value that is defined, that we set it at a specific value. And there are certain numbers in chemistry that that we define. For instance, definition. Let's do it this way. Let's say definitions. There are exactly 12 inches in 1 foot. In other words, 12 inches equals 1 foot. The feet and inches are defined in terms of each other, and there are exactly 12 inches, no more, no less, in a foot. If we go and we look at the SI system, we can say that there are 100 centimeters in 1 meter, or 1,000 millimeters in 1 meter, and that because these are within the same unit of measure, that these are definitions, and that there is no plus or minus included in them. And so when I define certain values, sometimes those values can be used without uncertainty, or at least what we would say is that there is no uncertainty in this equality. So these are equalities. Exact equalities. Okay. Let me check one thing. We go to 9:20. So we've got 15 more minutes. And what I want to do now is, we have covered the different types of measurements. What I want to show is why these measurements are important. And why this is really critical to understand. Okay, let's look at a box. And this box, I'm going to want to take and measure the area of the box. Let's see, I want that to click in. There it goes. It looks like a rectangle. That one line is off. We'll call it there. Now I feel better. Okay. And what I want to do is to look at this box, and let's say that the bottom of this box measures 10.0, and let's do it in inches, because we haven't really fully covered the metric system yet, and we'll get to that next time. And let's say that this side is 7 inches, so that different rulers were used to obtain the measurements of the sides of the box. And so there is different uncertainty within the different sides of the box. For instance, this one is plus or minus 1 inch, but this one down here is plus or minus 0.1 inch. And if I understand that correctly, then what that's telling me is that the length down here of this side of the box could be plus or minus a tenth, and that it could be as small as 9.99 inches, or it could be as big as 10.1 inches. And if I look at the other side, and understand how big that side is, that side varies by an entire inch. And so over here, what I'm seeing is that this could be as big or as small as 6 inches, or as big as 8 inches. And that's the uncertainty in that part of the measurement. Well, what that means is that if I want to look at the area of this box, an area equals the length times the width. The area is going to equal 7 times 10.0, and that is going to equal 70.0 inches. But the question is, what is the right answer? What is the uncertainty within this 70.0 inches? Well, that uncertainty needs to reflect this measurement. So let's take this and look at how big and how small this box might be. That's the change in the width of the box. And this is the uncertainty in the length of the box. And so the uncertainty that resides in the box is this area here. Let's do it in red. And let me see how big that should be adequate. Let's see, I'm gonna try to highlight this in. There. This represents the uncertainty in the area. The true uncertainty. That represents the true uncertainty in the area based on the measurements and the rulers that were used to measure the different sides, okay? And the question is, if I take and I report the measurement and I say that this area is equal to 7 times 10, or 7 inches times 10.0 inches, and that equals 70.0 inches, that would be a measurement that would be plus or minus 0.1 inches squared. There we go, that makes a little bit better. And that means that that box could be 70.1 inches squared through 69.9 inches squared. Does that uncertainty, what I'm saying is this uncertainty here, does this uncertainty look like it matches the uncertainty that I have drawn in red? Do they look like they match together? Does this area look like it is plus or minus 0.1? No. The uncertainty that is here looks much larger than this uncertainty that I'm reporting, doesn't it? And so what we have in chemistry is a system for estimating uncertainty in a calculation. And we call that system significant figures. So this system, significant figures, sometimes called significant digits, this is a system for estimating uncertainty in a calculation. And there are a set of rules for understanding how many significant figures there are in a measurement, and then a set of rules for applying them to calculations, both addition and subtraction and multiplication and division. And so this system has rules for understanding how many sig figs are in a individual measurement. And rules for how to apply them in a calculation. Now, we don't have time today to go through all those rules. We're going to do that in the next class. We'll go through all those rules in our next lecture. But what we'll do is we'll look at these measurements really quickly. And what we can say is that in this measurement here, the 7 represents one significant digit. And the 10.0 represents 3 significant digits. And in a simplistic way, the calculation cannot be any more accurate than the data that goes in. You can think about sort of this old saying, junk in to a calculation equals junk out. They used to say that in terms of a computer program, that junk in equals junk out. The accuracy of the result can only be as good as the data that goes in. And so in multiplication and division, we always defer to the smallest number of sig figs. So in other words, this number has 1, this number has 3. My result is only allowed to have 1 significant digit. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to copy this box. Let's throw it down here. And let's show just quickly how we go through and do this. So applying significant figures. Seven inches times 10.0 inches. I always do my sig figs in a particular color. This is 1 sig fig. This is 3 sig figs. The answer, when I place the answer, has to have the smallest number. So I find whichever one of these is the smallest number, the one sig fig, and this answer must be rounded. To one sig fig, to the smallest number. Now, this is for multiplication and division. Addition and subtraction have different rules. We're not going to cover addition and subtraction today. We'll do that next week. But for here, to round this, what I do is I drop down a line after my one sig fig, and I look at the number on the right-hand side, and if that number on the right-hand side is greater than 5, I round up. And if it's less than 5, I drop those digits off. Now, when I drop those digits off, I'm going to report this still as 70, but it is going to be 70 square inches plus or minus 10 square inches. In other words, the uncertainty resides in one sig fig in the tens place. And the uncertainty then is being carried into that, which means that the uncertainty in the measurement, as I read this 70 square inches, I lost my squared again, 70 squared inches plus or minus 10 squared inches. That means that the measurement can be as big as 80 square inches and as small as 60 square inches. And that is plus or minus my 10. And when I look at that, that is what this box is. This box is plus or minus 10 square inches. And so you could see that if I were at the outskirts of this measurement, that I would be closer to the 80 square inches for the box. And if I were at the inside measurement, I would be closer to the 60 square inches for the box, and that they average out to the 70 square inches, which is the black line. So when we go through and we do calculations, we need to be cognizant of how good the measurements are that go into that calculation. And we need to make sure that the uncertainty in the answer matches the least certain value that was put into that calculation. So that we, when we look at the calculated value, we have an understanding of how much uncertainty there is in the calculated value. So that's why we have all these different number types. That's why we take measurements in the precise way that we do. And it's why we have the different types of numbers, numbers which are counted and definitions versus measured in the way that we use them. And this is just an introduction to how we treat numbers. First off, how we do measurements. But then secondly, the next lecture, when you come back on Tuesday, we'll talk all about how we actually identify how many sig figs are in a measurement and how we use them. What are the rules specifically for addition and subtraction and how they are different from the rules of multiplication and division. And then we'll get some good practice. I will tell you that this is the bane of the chemistry student's existence. And it doesn't matter whether it's 30A, it doesn't matter if it's Chem 1A or Chem 1B, sig figs and sig figs rules are unnecessarily complicated. I think that what happens is the wording in them sometimes confuses students. And getting the sig figs right, they are in every single problem throughout the entire semester. It always comes down to sig figs. And trying to understand how many sig figs are in our measurements and how many sig figs are supposed to be in an answer. And it is one of the things that students have the most trouble in throughout the entire course of chemistry. So that's why I like to put an emphasis on it and get us on the right foot out of the gate in terms of trying to understand both the significance, the importance, and the how we go through and do these, okay? So no assignment for you guys to complete today. We will have an assignment that we will complete mostly together next Tuesday. And for those of you following asynchronously and watching the video asynchronously, you will have time to complete that assignment after we go through this next lecture as well. Okay. How did we do? Did any questions come up in terms of of the material covered. I'm sure that understanding this area and understanding the Sig Figs rules, there's going to be some questions there. We're going to clear that up next time. But I hope that I've communicated the importance of why we go through this topic and given you a short preview of where we're going with it. Okay, so if you guys are doing all right, I propose that we cut it here. I always stay on the line for a little bit. And so if you want to stay and you want to ask questions individually, you are more than welcome to do that. And if not, then have a happy and safe weekend. Watch the heat. We've got a heat warning. It's supposed to get smoking hot this weekend. And I'll see you guys on Tuesday. And don't forget, Monday's a holiday. So if you have other classes that fall on Mondays, no class this Monday. All right. You guys are welcome. Take care.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I'll see you on Tuesday. Daisy, did you have a question? Are you hanging on the line or is your channel just open? Sometimes the channel's just open. Okay, no reply. I'm going to guess that you're not there. I'm going to cut it here. Have a good weekend. We'll see you later.